Bhadan Sawelamadam Bonchendagichivam Pedevenchola Kajen Champagonetesonte Kursantogingajonsadusun Every morning when I wake up, these are the first thoughts, the first prayers that arise in my mind. Always the same. And I make the wish that when I leave this body in the bhado, in the intermediate state afterwards, that these will be the first remembrances that will arise. That I remember the Guru, the lineage of Mahamudra, that I remember Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, which means awakening the truth, the community. To remember the Bodhisattva vow as a nobody serving nobody. And that I remember the four limitless, measureless qualities. In the deepest sense, this loving, compassionate, joyful equanimity. So, for many years, every day has started like this. And why not start a teaching like that? It's not because we chant something that suddenly the Dharma becomes a religion, you know. We don't have to be so much afraid of that. Maybe tomorrow I will bring a Buddha here. You know, it still doesn't become a religion, you know. It is a path. It's a path of liberation, a path of awakening based on inspiration. Inspiration, also trust, but it's an exploration. It's a path of exploring. Actually, a path of exploring life. Always, you know, these four wonderful discoveries of the Buddha called the Four Truths. Always the same story. You know, discovering that there is tension, discovering the causes for that tension, discovering how that can be, you know, absent, and then the way to get there. So an experienced practitioner is simply someone who gets there quickly. The others take longer. But that's the only difference. Actually, the difference between an experienced practitioner and the not so experienced is that hopefully the experienced ones makes less mistakes. There's a little bit less clinging, maybe. A little bit less grasping. Not so much buying into the seeming reality of phenomena, yeah, of our life experience. So actually this path of Mahamudra that I share with you, it's the same good old path that you know most of you know under the name of Vipassana, but it's always the same good old path, just different words, different. You can say the emphasis is a little bit different. So, for example, in the Mahamudra path, we do not hesitate to talk about gurus. And we have four gurus. I don't know, probably I taught it already last year. Probably, but it's good to have a reminder. Yeah, first guru, because that's the first prayer I do. Yeah, the first guru is, of course, the human guru. There was this Buddha, Shakyamuni, Gautama, yeah, Siddhartha, however you call him. Nobody knows him. We can project all the good qualities on him. He hasn't made a scandal and he cannot make one anymore. So he is like the perfect guru, and he started a marvelous teaching, 45 years, with marvelous students, and they have all become gurus in their own way, the women as much as the men. But all of these gurus, they have for their whole life, they have remained servants. They're not guru masters, they are guru servants. They were serving sentient beings. Okay? To become a guru is actually to enter a lineage of slaves. Okay? It's like you're completely bound by compassion. You're completely bound by love. You have no way out, you know? Self-willed, self-righteous attitudes have no chance. You know, you're just completely there to serve sentient beings. And that's coming from my teacher, my personal human guru, Geno Rinpoche. I had many different teachers, but he was the most important one. Some of you know, I stayed the last 11 years of his life. I stayed closely with him. He asked me to teach far too early, but that was his choice. So anyhow, Gendrin, he told me when I went into the teaching situation, into the retreat centers, where I would see 15 men here, 15 men there. We had four different groups here of men, and then we had four different groups of women, all in 3 years retreat. Altogether, we were more than 100 practitioners in retreats longer than 3 years. And when he told us what attitude to go, you go, you think you go in there as the master. No. You go in there as the servant. You serve. And this is your freedom, because there is less clinging to self-importance than you are able to serve. Everybody else just wants to go their own way, do their own things, you know, self-willed, yeah, ideas about what to do in life. Actually, our freedom is to serve. And the freedom of a Buddha is actually not to do what passes through the head of some ego-clinging person. You know, it's not that kind of freedom. The freedom of a Buddha is actually very predictable. He told us a Buddha is so predictable, because the other teachings say Buddha is unpredictable because he's so free, right? You cannot know. But from the point of view of other awakened beings, a Buddha is completely predictable, because a Buddha will always do what's best for the situation. There's no other choice. It's not the choice, oh, today I sleep. Today I'm not available. And next life, I take a vacation, you know, a sabbatical, you know. Yeah, it's not there. It's like, hey, bodhisattvas, bodhisattvis, they are free to serve, okay? So I'm very proud. I'm very proud to belong to this lineage of slaves. Yes? To make the point, a lineage of servants. And they have taken great care from generation to generation to pass on all the wisdom that they have received. That is like part of their duty. And in times of crisis, in times of war, in times of whatever might come along in this, on this planet, in this world, what is the most important? To keep the Dharma alive for future generations, to keep that wisdom alive of how to reach awakening, how to enter liberation for future generations. Yeah, this is the most important. We don't have much influence on what's happening around us. Huh? We don't have so much. We should try our best to stop all these cruelties. Definitely we should do our best. But somehow it's a little bit beyond our power. But what we can do is to live the Dharma so fully that it will go through and always reach the next interested human beings, those who are interested, those who are open, those who are ripe, so that it remains available. So with the incredible atrocities happening in Tibet and with the exodus of, you know, so many Tibetan practitioners while others were being killed, then their main wish was to preserve the and to live in an authentic way, to live the jewel of the Dharma and to pass it on. And we are benefiting from that. The terrible things which happened there and are still happening had one good aspect, that they left the country behind the Himalayas. They came to India where we could meet them. They came to different countries and they're willing to serve. So that's basically what it means to have a lineage. Yeah, the human, I'm still talking about the first guru. The lineage is a lineage of inspiring examples that are so inspiring that we feel, oh, I mean, it's very daring to say, but I wish I could become like them. You know, it's like very daring. And when Gendo Rinpoche looked at us, he laughed and he said, no, you should become better than me. You should become better, you know, like everyone should always, you know, the potential should ripen more quickly. And don't hesitate to have this inspiration to become like the awakened ones. Trust your capacity. You can be like that. Yes? So this is the transmission of trust in a real lineage. It's that transmission that started, as much as we know, with the Buddha, who told to everybody that he met, you can be free, just like me. No difference. He never made a difference between himself and others. He always said, you can be free, you can be free. And then they asked, how? And he said, okay, like this, try like this, go this way. For you, this will be good. This is your question. This is the answer. So he showed many different ways of how to become free. And he always encouraged everybody in that capacity to become free. Later on, this capacity to be free was called Buddha nature. You know, the potential to become a Buddha. Tathagata Garba, the technical term. So that's a transmission lineage which goes through the ages, which makes no difference between men and women, and even talks about other sentient beings like animals and the invisible beings, that they all can become free because they all have this potential. So it's a very, can say, there's a vision of reality, that reality is actually all potential Buddhas. And the relationship with the world is one of nourishing, cultivating this Buddha nature in everybody that we need, that we meet. So in the Mahamudra language, like for example in the prayer, the famous Mahamudra prayer of the third Kamapa, we call this cultivating Buddha fields. Cultivating Buddha fields means that, you know, how many people we are in this room, you know, we have as many Buddha fields in this room as we have beings here. Okay, the mind stream of every one of us is called a Buddha field. And a guru is a gardener, is cultivating the garden, the pure land of each one's Buddha field. Yeah, like, so bringing about what is already there, enhancing the qualities to come up. That's what is the outer lineage. The lineage with human gurus is one of serving and becoming a gardener. Yes, becoming a gardener, cultivating Buddha fields everywhere. And then the second kind of guru is what we call in Tibetan the Peja Lama, the guru of the textual transmission. Because the outer guru is not there so much, so often. We can't sit on her lap or his lap all the time, you know. But in those days when we are not with a human guru, we can rely on the texts, on the audios, on the videos, on what we have nowadays. All of that is the guru of the words. And the guru of the words is actually speaking through us with the same voice as the actual living guru. And the living guru helps us to understand the text, so we can take the text home and we understand more of what is meant. And some of us, we receive great blessing from just opening one of those wonderful Dharma texts, as if the Buddha was talking directly to us. Yeah. As if all the masters were in our presence. We can actually contact them by the blessing of the living lineage, entering the textual transmission. We can receive blessing as if we were in the presence of a person teaching us directly. Like I have this book lying here in front of me just as a blessing, you know. This is a Mahamudra book which I've been teaching extensively. But just for it to lie there, just to be there and occasionally look at the word, it's like, it's a mind opener. And if you know that experience, then you can just open any Dharma book, a Dharma text, anything that you feel a connection with, and it's as if meeting the Buddha in person. And that's the second kind of guru. Huh? It's the guru of the, you can say, the word transmission. In previous times, when it wasn't written down, there was the recital of the words of the teachings. So that was like kept alive in memory. So that would be the same thing. Yes? And then we have the third guru. The third guru is life itself. It's the guru of the situations, also sometimes called the guru of the elements, because the five elements, earth, water, fire, wind, and space, with their characteristics, they combine to form every situation. We are made out of these five elements. This room is made out of it. The quality of the interaction is an expression of the five elements. So what we call the guru of the elements is actually our life teaching us. So we are never separate from the guru. That's also very wonderful instruction. The Guru never leaves us. Life is teaching us. However, we need to be able to read the teaching. We don't really know what life is teaching us. Yeah? What is this crazy situation now? What is this teaching me? What do I want to learn from it? What do I need to learn from it? The teaching of life is twofold. Or you can safely say it is at least twofold. There's always the mistakes that we keep on repeating, and they teach us a lot. So this is called the Karma Guru. Yeah? The guru of our habitual tendencies, repeating themselves, producing the same kind of stress in our life again and again until we learn. Okay, that's the easy one. And then there is a more ultimate teaching in every situation, which you can safely say it's also always there. It's life teaching us its own nature, the nature of phenomena. You know, life is teaching us about change, about impermanence. It's part of the nature of phenomena, right? Life is teaching us its ungraspable nature, the shunya nature, the anatta nature. Life is teaching us all the time. We just need to be aware of it. But life is teaching us more. Life is teaching us about the ever-present quality of compassion, this resonance we have been talking about. Life is teaching us about joy. Life is teaching us about generosity. Life, you know, there's so much more. So that's the endless teaching of life. Yeah, I won't go into it. But this is the third guru. And thanks to the first and the second guru, the alive gurus and the textual transmission, the word transmission, then these two, they give us the keys how to read everyday situations, yeah, how to make good use of them. For example, I have very difficult children, you know, I mean, they are all over. They are so restless, so excited, you know, and then I need a key. I need a key. What is the key? What is the key? You know. And then I check with the human guru. I check with the text. Oh, maybe the key is if I put myself into their place. You know, maybe I need to have a little practice of Tonglen there. You know, maybe of beginning to see a little bit from their point of view. What they need, what are their fears, and so on. And take care of myself, and so on. You know, there's like different keys. I don't just always use the key of illusory nature. I would be a terrible mother or father if I say all of this is illusory. Yeah, illusory means it's not solid, so we can shape it. But if we don't do our job to shape the situations, you know, then we are not parents, actually. Yeah, we need to. This is then again karma. Huh? This is how to shape situations. So this is the active side of karma. And all of that we learn from the first two kinds of gurus. How to read the situations of life. How to take meaning out of them. And how to use it to progress. So it's a very important question always. When we come to the human guru, always, can you help me to read the situation? What can I learn there? What is possible? What is the potential of the situation? How is it possible? Like today I was asked, how is it possible to live with so much suffering? And yes, it is. Yeah. And then seeing the different levels of reality, you know, how that is possible. Yeah. Samsara has never been a nice place to be. Never. Yeah. It's suffering from beginning to end. even if you have a little vacation in the divine realms, you know, still so much holding on, so much clinging. So awakening is possible in samsara, and awakening is free of suffering. How is it? This is what life teaches us. Life gives us enough challenges so that we feel compelled to look for solutions. That's the beauty about this human life. Enough challenges. Yes. So don't complain, because this is the Guru visiting us. Yes. Yes, so these were the three first Gurus. And then we have the Guru of our own mind. This is the fourth one. The Guru of the nature of mind. Here we are talking about the non-dual mind. Here we are talking about awakened mind. We're talking about ground Mahamudra. Remember that ground of being which is non-dual, completely free, that nature which is always shining through. It's somehow it's there, but often we don't know how to contact it. And so the work of the first three gurus is to make us enter the fourth one. And like, again, I quote my dear Lama Genjin, my root guru. And he said, when the outer guru is sure that the disciple has entered a stable connection with the inner guru of one's own mind, then the disciple can be sent away. Then the guru has done the job. Then the disciple actually is not a disciple anymore, because it's so well rooted in its own basic nature that the Dharma will be there all the time. The truth is realized. Yeah, there is the understanding of life. It can continue on her own. Yeah, the student can continue on her own. But we always remain students of life, that we remain that all of our life, and we remain servants of sentient beings, because there's nothing else to do, actually. Yeah, what else should we do? Except maybe having a party. But then we can have a party serving sentient beings. So we do like this. Yeah? You understand the four gurus? Very important. To explain these four gurus is part of the preliminaries of Mahamudra. Okay? I just did a little job of explaining the preliminaries of Mahamudra concerning what is the deeper meaning of Guru Yoga. Because the whole Mahamudra can be explained in terms of Guru Yoga, which for us is not religious. It's also not blind devotion, but it is this deep appreciation. We are devotees of the human lineage of wisdom and compassion. We are devotees of the word transmission, and we take care that it is being preserved for future generations. We are devotees of life as a guru. And we are devotees of the nature of mind. You get it? Guru Yoga means to incorporate these four aspects. So our whole life can be seen as Guru Yoga. Why is this so important? Huh? Why would that be so important? Because the biggest obstacle to awakening is pride. Is self-importance. And this abandoning ourselves in the practice of Guru Yoga is actually helping us enormously with the pride, enormously with the self-importance. Yeah, we are not making up our own Dharma. We give in to life, we learn from it. And we actually dissolve all of that into the nature of mind. We let go of this self-importance that separates us from the nature of mind. So it's a very crucial understanding that actually we could turn our life into a constant practice of Guru Yoga, but an intelligent one. Not just following blindly the instructions of someone who calls himself or herself a guru. Now, that would be a little blind, and a lot of harm has come from that. Yeah, so we take care. So that was a little teaching on the four gurus. And before I talk too much, let's meditate. So, the meditation of Mahamudra is actually Guru Yoga. The key instruction is to let the Buddha meditate. If you feel there is a kind of openness, a devotion in you, you can imagine that the Buddha, in whatever form you wish to visualize, actually as a being of light comes into our heart, dissolves through the top of the head into our heart, and takes on the form of a sphere of light. Any color you wish. The tradition loves this blue color of the autumn sky after the monsoon rains, you know, when the sky in India was completely blue and clear. And then to give that bluish sphere of light, rainbow colored rays of light emanating from it. Very vibrant, alive. Actually, only a bridge, a symbol of the presence of Buddha nature in ourselves. So allow that Buddha nature to meditate. From time to time, remember the light in your heart, the Buddha meditating. Those of us who wish to continue are invited to continue their practice silently. There is a 20-minute break, which you can use for walking, getting some refreshments, and then we continue. One thing you can know for sure, the Buddha didn't look like this. That's Greek invention. You know, there was no image of the Buddha before about 300 years before Christ. Yes, there was nothing like this. It was after the invasion of, you know, when Alexander, this so-called great, Alexander, this dictator, you know, who was a kind of imperialist, then when he crossed the Hindu Kush, he got a little tired. And in the kingdom of Gandhara, which was a Buddhist kingdom, and nowadays Pakistan, Kashmir, and that region, this Gandhara kingdom lasted for about 7 centuries. It was a mostly Buddhist place. And of course, Alexander wasn't traveling alone. He brought artists with him. And they were so surprised. Hey, you talk to us about this Buddha, but you have not a single image of the Buddha. And they tried out different versions. Yeah. They tried out the Buddha as a prince, the Buddha as a warrior on a horse, on a, you know, and the sitting meditating Buddha won the prize. And however, they put this kind of curly bluish hair on him. He definitely was shaven all his life long. You know, he was more like you and me, you know, like he was definitely closer to us. And he only ate one meal per day. And you know, when he attained enlightenment, he was only bones. Yes, he was only bones. So I don't think he had much of a fattening cure the rest of his life. Since he was walking all the time and eating only one meal per day, he was probably really thin. Yeah, very thin. But you know, we like to think of him as having this beautiful hair and the splendor of the magnificent rounded shoulders. And yeah, because this is what the inner eyes see. Okay? This is not a picture of the outer Buddha. This is a picture, this is like these statues that represent the inner Buddha. And there is such a radiance there, such a peace, such a love and, you know, benevolence coming from the eyes and so on. And then they try to put this into form. And that's how we get these garden Buddhas everywhere, you know, who are now decoration in every good restaurant. And so just because they remind us of peace and serenity and how we can actually be if we relax, if ever. If ever we relax, we can be like this. And when I was looking with my partner for a nice statue in one of these bamboo gardens, you know, close to Lake Constance in the south of Germany, we found a Buddha. Because often these Buddha statues, they are very feminine. Because there is something in this development towards awakening where the male and female qualities, they get mixed. And many images, many statues, many rupas, we call them, they express this coming together of male and female qualities. And then so we have decided she is a she. So she is our Buddha. Yeah. But she was sold as a Buddha. But, you know, transsexual gender issues, we don't have, you know. She is a she, and we want her to be a feminine inspiration, because this is what the world needs nowadays. I think if the Buddha were to come these days, she would come as a Buddha. Yes, definitely. Like Tara, you know, like Tara, she took the vow to always appear in female form. Because she saw that was a little lopsided, you know, the tradition of women had to be strengthened. And so she put more weight on that side. And you can look around here, look into the room, you know. There are so many women walking the path, reaching insights, becoming free. And yeah, that's the future. Okay, back to our practice of Mahamudra. So when we have the Buddha meditating in our heart, we are actually using a method of visualization, of imagination, to allow for the best of ourselves to take the lead. Okay? The best of ourselves is that what we call the Buddha qualities in ourselves. To imagine that there is a Buddha meditating in our heart is a very beneficial lie. Yeah? It's like, it's not true. There is no one to be found in there, and there's nothing special about the heart. He could be sitting in the belly as well. He could be sitting in our knees, you know. He could be on top of our head or on our shoulders. That's not the point. But it is like where we feel that normally there is our me, I, and, you know, I feel like this, you know. Then we We go here to the center of our being. So in the so-called center of our being, that's where we invite the Buddha compassion, the Buddha wisdom. That's why we place Buddha, awakened being, in our heart. There is many visualizations where the Buddha sits in the chakra of the throat. There are many visualizations where it is in the chakra of the head, on top of the head. And there are visualizations at the navel and below the navel. Buddhas are invited everywhere. Okay? And you know the famous, you know, it's called the Samantabhadra wishing prayer. It's a famous Mahayana wishing prayer where a Buddha sits in every pore of our skin, surrounded by countless other Buddhas. So every little part of our so-called body, which means our identification, we invite that Buddha presence into every cell. And it becomes a limitless universe. We are actually working, and this is why I talk about it, it's very typical for Mahamudra. We are working with expanding our vision into pure realms, into realms of, wow, unlimited awareness. So if we say there's a Buddha in every cell surrounded by countless other Buddhas, actually we say there is awareness. There is non-dual awareness everywhere. No limits to it. And that's different. That's different when we meditate with this. Can you check this out for a moment for yourself? Imagine that all the tingling in your body, all the vibrations, all the vibrations from the top of the head down to the tips of the toes and the tips of the fingers, that all of these vibrations in the body, that they are all the humming sound of the Dharma being taught. The humming sound of Dharma. The alive presence of freedom of awakening. Can almost feel the vibrating energy of timeless awareness. Well, before I get too absorbed in that, let's make the connection to the teaching that we heard before. Remember the third line of the Anapanasati Sutta? Breathing in, I experience the pranakaya. Breathing out, I experience the pranakaya. The simple translation is the breathing body. Yeah. More profound, prana are the subtle energies flowing through everywhere. And kaya is the respectful word for body. So, taking this deeper than in the normal flow of prana, of this breath, the subtle breath, the subtle energies, then the prana flow is actually mixed with clinging. It's mixed with the kleshas. Okay? It's the flow, it's the you know that when you are afraid, how your body energies tighten. You can feel the fear in certain areas of the body. When you're angry, you know that other areas tighten. When you are full of desire, you feel that still yet other areas tighten. And you know the characteristic posture of pride. You know how jealousy deforms, you know how it forms and deforms the body. So all the kleshas, the kilesas, if you want to pronounce like this, they have an impact on the way the subtle energies flow. And they create blockages. Nowadays, we know a lot about so-called body memory, but actually it's the impact of emotional stress on our energy system. And when there is release of trauma, release of emotional stress, then you can feel there is a lot happening in your energy body. The prana begins to circulate differently. Now, the prana in an awakened person circulates incredibly well. It's the free-flowing energy. You know this maybe for moments where you were into samadhi already, that you could sit for long, you didn't feel any pain, you know, you were absorbed. And there's so much more harmony in your whole body-mind. You know, what the mental state and the body state, they go together. Now, the pranakaya of a meditating Buddha is then called the kaya, the body of a prana, which is called the jnana prana, the body of timeless awareness. Okay? It's the prana flow of that timeless non-dual awareness where there are no more blockages. So when we meditate ourselves in Mahamudra, and we say the Buddha meditates, actually we enter an awareness of allowing for totally harmonious flow. We give permission that the Buddha energy of awareness, of non-dual timeless awareness, takes over, which then actually means that is Buddha in every cell of our body. That is Buddha everywhere in the lymph ways, everywhere in the blood vessels, everywhere in the organs, you know. No more clinging. Because we meditate directly in an openness that is as far as we go into being open without the activity of kleshas, of the afflictions, the afflicting emotions. It's a shortcut. It's a shortcut of saying, well, actually, yes, it's possible. Just be, and it's not just being ordinary, but just be as a Buddha would be. And we allow that ground Mahamudra, you know, the basic nature, we allow that to surface in our meditation. That's the path Mahamudra. The past Mahamudra is allowing the ground Mahamudra to manifest. The path is to allow the ground of our being, that which is not touched by the kleshas, allows that to manifest. And yes, that takes trust. And actually, the word we use to explain what this trust does to us, we call it blessing. Christians would probably call it grace, but it's the same thing. I mean, it's not a thing. It's the same experience. Yeah, blessing. Blessing means waves of inspiration. So we allow the blessing to guide our meditation. And blessing is very much connected to joy. Inspiration is always connected to a joyful energy. Yeah? Blessing is connected to opening. Opening to something that is kind of, we often say greater than ourselves, but if it just means that the clinging to our own importance just has to give way, there is something more powerful, more true. So we let this blessing take over. And again, before I talk too much, let's do it. I mean, doing in the sense of non-doing. Imagine that your most beloved Buddha or Buddhi is in front of you. Is really give it all the colors and light and luminosity and vibrant energy that you're able to project into space. You know, she or he is really there in the full radiance, the full splendor of awakening. And this awakened, luminous sphere, looking like a human, talks to us and says, "Oh, my dear, good that you are here. Welcome. You are not different from me. What you see is actually your own true nature." And with that, this luminous Buddha dissolves into only light, and that light enters my own stream of being. And then just sit in that. Enter the blessing of the awakened dimension in yourself. So you see the methods of Mahamudra, they are like this. They work with a change of vision, a change of attitude. Not focusing on the problem anymore, but entering the solution. Yeah, that's the big difference. We are not so much preoccupied with purification, purifying the kleshas, working through the habitual tendencies, and so we go as much as we can directly into that solution of just being this natural joy, devoid of any complexities, of any elaborations, you know, this prapancha. Yeah. Just natural being, free from all the dualistic labeling, analysis, and so on. That's the different touch of the practice. So it can only work for those who are ready for that. When you're not willing or happy to enter that natural state, and if there's no trust whatsoever in this ground of being Buddha nature, then it won't work. Yeah, it's like we have to go a different way. But if that is this basic trust, and we know, we have a feeling, an intuition for this, as Trungpa Rinpoche called it, basic goodness. Yeah, and the term Samantabhadra can also be translated as basic goodness. It is a term for the all good Buddha nature in us. So this basic nature that is not affected by all the turbulences of life, if we feel we can trust that, then this is a possible path for us. We don't have to take care to solve all the turbulences. We can connect through the turbulences, through the storm of life, into the source, into the ground of our being. So that becomes our path, to connect as often as possible, to enter as often as possible that simplicity of being with that innate joy, serenity, with that innate compassion, resonance. And that's what we call Mahamudra practice. Yeah, that is, if you want to call something Mahamudra practice, then it is this touchdown again and again. Relaxing, letting go of all the identifications which are characteristic of the klesha activity, the dualistic activity of mind. If one can, then no need to deal with it, just stepping out, letting go of the identification that is the source of all of that, into the ground of our being. You should know that ground of being is only a word. There is no ground. It is that groundless ground. Yeah, we are, you all agree, groundless ground sounds good, huh? It makes real sense. Yeah, and this is what I'm talking about. Yeah, that selfless self, you know, the groundless ground. Okay. So, if you are okay with that, that's a direct path. It helps a lot. It has helped me a lot. And has helped me to let go of the efforts, you know, all the efforts by wanting to get somewhere. So it becomes very obvious that we are not going anywhere. We are simply opening to the nature of what is right now. And that's going nowhere because it's right here. And then just to finish that teaching of ground, path and fruit, then the fruit will be at some point that actually this body, heart, mind, presence is Buddha, is the flow of awakened prana, of non-dual prana. It becomes more and more that, and I don't know where it will take us, but it must be quite good. Yeah, what I could see with those who have gone far, they were very happy examples of the human species. Yes, very inspiring, you know, having lived through terrific, terrorizing experiences, but the mind, heart, mind, so free, such a good sense of humor, and such a love, and so much, yeah, so much fluidity, flexibility. So that's quite inspiring, actually. Again, the human guru being very inspiring, and then you feel inspired to walk the path. I was 22 years old when I met Gendan Rinpoche. I was lucky. He came to Freiburg, a small town in southwestern Germany, once in his lifetime. Someone had managed to invite him. And he was teaching there, this great guru whom the 16th Karmapa has sent to Europe as his best meditation master. And there he was in the town of Freiburg teaching a weekend on bodhicitta, you know, the heart mind of awakening. We were 30, 40 people. My girlfriend said, you shouldn't miss that. You know, I was at that time very ardent Vipassana practitioner. And not quite yet. No, I was in Zen at that time. Yes, I was in Zen practice. So to get things straight. Yeah. So long ago. 22. And for the first time in my life, I met a completely authentic being. You know, from after listening half an hour, 1 hour, I was just like, wow. Yeah, it's like I told you maybe already, it is possible. It is possible to be authentic. For me, since that time, authenticity, to be authentic and free, has become synonymous to Buddhahood, you know, synonymous to what is awakening. The other teachers, like Daigo Khyentse Rinpoche, head of the Nyingma lineage, and 16th Karmapa, head of the Kagyu lineage, they said of Gendun, he has reached the state of Vajradhara, which means the state of supreme awakening. No further travel, no further way to go. Yeah, so there are some very capable human beings who said such a thing about this man. And there he was sitting in a room smaller than this. If you cut here where the pillar is, you know, this is how big the room or small the room would be. It was a living room. The living room of a good old German lady who offered her house for teachers to come by. And it was my first Buddhist teacher I ever met, because until then I was in these groups, but we didn't have a teacher. We had some books like Philip Kaplow, The Three Pillars of Zen, you know, these early books. I don't know what else we had, but very soon we had the books of Joseph Goldstein, you know, the 31 days of Vipassana, 30 days of Vipassana retreat. Things like this were circulating, yeah? Early teachers. And there he was, so simple, so much laughing, just loving us. He didn't understand a word of our language. We didn't understand a word of his language. He was translated from Tibetan into English. The English was translated into German. And he left such an impression on me, such an incredible impression that afterwards, when I started practicing Vipassana, I always looked for this bodhicitta. And I was in Splett's house, a place in southern England where Mother Sayama was teaching, you know, my Burmese teacher of the same tradition as Goenka. Her teacher was Uba Kin, for those of you who know. And so Mother Sayama and Uchitin were teaching there, and I was going through the library, where is this bodhicitta teaching, you know? Just having heard it once for this weekend, you know, this incredibly heart-opening teaching of someone who was at the service of everybody and was laughing his head off with our little questions that we had and just pouring out his love and wisdom and his freedom, you know. It was, for me, I thought, everybody's teacher is like this. Wow, great news. And then I found out it's not like that. And then finally I found back to him. Yes, but then I stayed later on when I was 20. From 26 on, I stayed in retreat with him. Then I was only practicing with him. And so this encounter is like, it's like Mahamudra in action. That's why I talk about this. This is the fruit. The fruit is to become a normal person. Yeah, we can start right now, huh? We are already normal, and then we become more normal. The difference is that the normality then is sane, and now we are insane. Okay, you get it? We are troubled. But the normality, now with him sitting on the ground, drinking water, and when you ask him about his life story, he says, oh, my life, yeah. I drank tea and I ate sampa. Sampa is this cereal in Tibet. Yeah. You know, and that natural, that simple, and I love that about awakening. That's why I dare to take the word awakening so often in my mouth, because for me, it's so normal, so natural. It's just becoming normal, finally. Finally becoming natural. And when I think this good old man Buddha walking through India, I see a normal man walking through India. Normal in the sense of, yes, radiant with love, incredible wisdom, but just sitting normally under the tree. Nothing to do, nothing to do. Breathing in, breathing out. You know, just like that. Nothing special. So this is this idea of nothing special is so important to the Mahamudra tradition that they called the awakened mind, they called it in Tibetan Tamalgi Shepa. Shepa means consciousness, and Tamal is the word for ordinary people. You know, the ordinary people in the villages, they're called the Tamalpas. And Tamalgi Shepa is the ordinary mind, which is the name for the awakened mind. Okay, just to communicate this, hey, don't look for something special. And that helped me so much, because without the instructions of my master, I wouldn't have noticed the ordinary mind when it came by. It was too ordinary. It was nothing special. Because it was a gap. The ordinary mind is a gap in the clinging consciousness. The clinging consciousness, the dualistic consciousness, doesn't get the gap. It's not aware of it because it's not an object that you can be aware of. You can only live it. So this gap in the ordinary stream of dualistic consciousness, it's difficult to notice if no one helps us to recognize it. Because it's an absence of the ordinary processes that we are so familiar with. There's no observing activity there. So when someone asks me, are you enlightened? Then I say, definitely not. Because how could an I be enlightened? No one is there, you know. No one is there to witness. There's no witness there, no observer. There's no one evaluating the experience, whether it was a good or mediocre enlightenment. Maybe not so good. It doesn't exist. It's only ordinary mind. Simplicity, okay? That's what we are heading for. Absolute simplicity. So you know awakening by the after effects. That's how you know. Awakening shows by the after effects. When you come back to normal dualistic senses, then you notice something has profoundly changed. Something is not as before. Actually, you can, with a little smile in the face, you can say it is like sobering out. You know, that is a word for when you have been drunk and you become sober again. We were drunk, we were intoxicated with self-importance. And the sobering out is coming back to senses of not important. This sobering out, this is what is actually happening. And you feel the effects of that in the stream of a being. It's like sobering out. That is not the same as before anymore. So there is a powerful non-experience that is called awakening. You follow me? It's a non-experience because it is not a dualistic experience. And all the experiences we normally talk about, we can describe them. And here it is an indescribable experience of just being, no words, doesn't leave the usual memory trace, and has the power to transform our normal beliefs in reality, in self, solidity, you know, existence, and all the rest. These beliefs. It has an incredible power. So the Mahamudra practice is made, actually is like, has developed in a way to allow for those gaps, to allow for some sanity, some sobering out to show itself. We do have teachings of how to deal with emotions, but they are basically not so different. Except if you go to the tantric methods. So Mahamudra is a tantric practice. It's the basic, you can say the Mahamudra is the approach behind Buddhist Tantra. Yeah, that's what is the main method. But otherwise, the other ways of dealing with emotions are not so different from what you know. However, the most important method is to look straight into the emotion, to turn into the essence, the nature of the emotion, and to discover there's never been anything there. And this is a discovery you need to make for yourselves. So we can see what we talk in the next days, what we share. But now we have, you know, it's the morning of the second day and we have finished, you can say, the introduction to Mahamudra. Yes, this was a little introduction. And you get a taste of what we are doing.